Of course, this morning, that today is September 11th, so I just wanted to talk about that a little bit. So we're obviously not going to make it through all of the Makaros. This is a shiur that's normally not given on September 11th. So let's start a little bit with one of the interesting and colorful mitzvahs of Parshas Ki Tetzeh, the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen. Parshas Ki Tetzeh is the most dense parsha of mitzvahs. It has the greatest, the deepest concentration of mitzvahs, the most density of mitzvahs. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't reveal schar to us because religion is not schar-centric. It's not some big tab in Shamayim, how many points and how much Olam Haba. We'll talk about this a little bit later. So Hashem wants to direct our attention away from schar. And there are only two mitzvahs that HaKadosh Baruch Hu stresses the schar for, Shiluach HaKen and Kibud Avayim. One is a mitzvah chamura. Kibud Avayim is probably the hardest mitzvah. That's why you need really good role models. It's one of the mitzvahs you can't learn from a sefer. It's almost impossible to learn from a sefer. Everything you learn from a sefer melts away in real time when you have to face the challenges of different generations and aging and trying to find your own identity. And sometimes that comes at the cost of your relationship with your parents. So Kibud Avayim is one of those mitzvahs. You really have to identify good role models. I don't know if you've had good role models. If you had, you're very fortunate. If you haven't had good role models, try to find them. Try to, when you meet new people this year, try to, especially if you see them with their parents and they're really excellent at Kibud Avayim, it's good to try to. I watched Rav Lichtenstein perform Kibud Avayim. It was just incredible to see. And the other mitzvah is an easy mitzvah, Shiluach HaKen. And in part, Hashem's telling us that don't start ranking mitzvahs. Can you imagine we started ranking mitzvahs, which has more schar, which has less schar? We start to become very excited about certain mitzvahs and invest in them, and other mitzvahs maybe less so. So there are two messages. One is we're not schar obsessed. We don't think about schar. If Hashem told you there weren't Olam Haba, would anyone change their lifestyle? We're here just for Olam Haba, only to get a reward? Or we see religion, and we'll talk about this a little bit later maybe, as self-sufficient, as the best way to lead your life even without Olam Haba, as the most dignified life of value and content, even if HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't offer a reward in the next world. And also not to rank mitzvahs and to be careful. Sometimes in life, certain mitzvahs get our attention and warrant our interest and our investment. And other mitzvahs we're a little bit lackadaisical about, we're a little bit relaxed about. So let's be careful about all mitzvahs, and that's why the Torah chooses polar opposites. Easy mitzvahs and difficult mitzvahs, the mitzvah of Kibud Avayim, mitzvah chamura, the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen, which is the mitzvah kala, and creates equality, and creates symmetry of schar, just that they're the same. Again, just to remind everyone in the shir, drinks, yes. Food, no. Gum, no. Okay, so drinks, anyone drinking, keep drinking. Anyone eating and chewing, please make sure. Every chuk has their own rules and regulations, so no one should be embarrassed that they haven't really found out what the expectations are in this one. Now, when the Torah describes Shiluach HaKen, it provides a very, very interesting introduction. Let's read the Pasuk, and the Pasuk is an interesting set of words, and those words lead to an interesting drash in the Gemara. Ki yikarei kan tzipar lefonecha, the first source. If you happen upon a bird's nest, ki yikarei, it just happens. You discover, surprise, you uncover a bird's nest. You weren't planning it. But derech, you're on the road, you're just traveling somewhere. You're going, you're not looking for the bird's nest. You're traveling from your town to a business meeting. You're traveling for vacation. And you just happen to discover, ki yikarei, kan tzipar lefonecha. In fact, the Gemara in Chulin Darshan, source number two, that you can't schedule or choreograph kansipor. Let's say you build a nest in your dining room. Maybe your mind won't be so happy. You build a nest in your backyard, and then you go to perform Shiluach HaKen. You're not yotze to the mitzvah. It has to be unprepared. It has to be serendipitous. You just chanced upon it. You didn't plan it. Circumstances. Pratlim Azuman, source number two, Ilema. The Gemara is discussing some halacha. Maybe the halacha is talking about a scenario. Davalei ken betoch beso. You have a nest in your house. The akdashe. And the Gemara is talking about Hekdash there for some reason. Mi Mechayev, is that a case where you're Mekayim in the midst of Shiluach HaKen? The Gemara says, Ki Yikarei Kan Tzipor Lefonecha, problem is Zuman. You can't prepare it. It can't be waiting for you. You can't schedule. It can't be microwavable. You pop it in the microwave, Mekayim in the mitzvah. It has to be something that you're not planning for. Now, of course, every mitzvah is a specific mitzvah. But being that Torah is integrated, Hashem's logic is integrated, every mitzvah carries a message about the entire system. So in every mitzvah, there's some truth about the entire system. So there's a lot to do about Shiluach HaKen, but in Shiluach HaKen, this is also paradigmatic of the entire system. Perry, welcome. Here you have a sheet. Paradigmatic of the entire system. What do I mean of the entire system? Success in life is about planning. You can't just live life haphazard and chaotic and flying by the seat of your pants. Life requires planning. We're now planning 40 days for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur because we don't want to walk in and back into Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We want there to be some expanded religious consciousness, some tonality, some attunement to these great days. And you can feel Elul, and a lot of boys that complain about being outside of yeshiva and missing Shiva, they don't complain so much about Hanukkah. Hanukkah you can reproduce outside of yeshiva. They don't complain so much. But they really, really miss Elul. It's very, very difficult to generate religious intensity when your environment and surroundings don't support. I really wish I could be there for Elul. I really wish I could be there so that when I enter Rosh Hashanah, I enter it with traction, I enter it with momentum. It pains me sometimes when I see that sometimes Rosh Hashanah falls on Sunday night or Yom Kippur falls on Sunday. And I hear people are watching football or watching games. You can't back into Rosh Hashanah. You can't just be involved in one. A couple of years ago, there was a big controversy in New York because the New York Jets scheduled one of the football team, their opener or one of the games. It was opener, it was Erev Rosh Hashanah, and it was scheduled for 4 o'clock. And I was so sad by that conversation. And if it's at 1 o'clock, you should be watching a game. That's where you are, Erev Rosh Hashanah. You're in a stadium with 60,000 people getting drunk, shouting at the top of your lungs when tomorrow you can be blowing the shofar and asking Hashem for Chaim and Mesim. I mean, just basic religious sensitivity. Take one day and prepare for it. I would hope that one day in your house, Erev Rosh Hashanah, if it's a Sunday, at the very least, there's no sports on. You watch sports, enjoy sports, it's perfect, it's a wonderful outlet, it's wonderful. But those couple hours, there should be some mental focus. And you shut down sports, and you shut down movies, and you... I always feel like, not that I go to so many activities, Matzei Shabbos with my wife. We have a very quiet life, and I'm busy Matzei Shabbos. But you know, Slichos night, we're not out, you know, recreationally. Slichos night is Slichos night. You get ready for Slichos, and you prepare for that intense launch of the period leading up. So life's about planning. It's about organization, and the lack of organization, and chaos, and mayhem, that's seen as a religious flaw, a religious limitation. How is Amalek described in the end of our parsha? Asher karcha baderech. Source number 3, Asher karcha baderech. So the word karcha is a play on words. It means they chilled you. We were hot. We were flaming. We were frightening to everyone. And by challenging us, they made us a little bit more human. And it was easier for others to challenge us. Chazal talk about this. Rashi quotes the famous medrash of a hot bath. And someone jumps in and cools it for other people. But the simple reading, Asher karcha, is that Amalek didn't have any long-standing plan, at least the way the Pasuk describes it. Amalek didn't have any long-standing plan to ambush the Jews. They were pirates. They just picked on vulnerable travelers in the desert. They picked on whoever passed them. And it didn't make any difference whether you're Jew, whether you're Egyptian, whether you're Canaanite. If you were in the desert and you were hungry and you were tired and you were defenseless, they capitalized. They took you prisoner. They took you captive. They ambushed. They ravaged. Shakarcha. They just happened. They didn't target the Jews. Almost as if that's part of their malignance is that they were just haphazard. Had they had something out for the Jews, and of course according to Chazal, Amalek is a child of Esav, so there's something else happening in Chazal. But this way the Torah presents it, had they had some beef with the Jewish people, that would be more excusable. But what makes them sound notorious is that they're karcha baderech. They're just willing to challenge and exploit whoever passes them. Or in Parshas Bichlokosai, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is lambasting us. And he lambasts us for betraying him, for being idolatrous. But what's worse than betrayal? Because when you betray Hashem, there's still a relationship. Even when you rebel, you're still rebelling. Rav Amitai would always tell us the story of the secularist anarchists in England. A little shout out for the British. Not such a good shout out. But the anarchists and the arch secularists in London in the late 19th century started a custom. It was called Kol Nidre Ball. In Kippur night, there was a ball. Everyone came dressed in their beautiful dresses and their suits, and they had a ball with food and dancing to stick it to the religious people, to show we're converting your holiest day into a night of celebration and dancing. And then there was a reactionary group who were even more anarchists that were upset with them, and they said, what makes it so special? It's just a regular night. By having a Kol Nidre ball, you're still showing that Yom Kippur is important. What makes it important? We should have a ball every night. So they wanted to. There's a big debate amongst the anarchists whether there should be a Kol Nidre ball. Because the opponents of the Kol Nidre ball said even by rebelling against Kol Nidre, you're still highlighting the day. You're still designating it as a special day. Ramita would always tell us in that context about when he was young and hungry or something, his grandfather told him about his neighbor who complained. The woman came to Rav Amital's father or grandfather in Hungary and complained, "My husband, he doesn't love me anymore. He hasn't hit me for an entire 2 months. So I miss him. He hasn't hit me for 2 months." Sometimes when you rebel, sometimes when you're violent, that's also. So what's worse than betraying Hashem? Sometimes when you rebel against Hashem, that's also a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's when you're uneven, when you're inconsistent, when you look at the world as a world of fate and fortune and chance, and it's not complete. You ignore Hashem's providence. Some people are angry at Hashem, but they recognize that Hashem supervises his world. They're just angry with him. Some people forget. Some people just ignore HaKadosh Baruch Hu and attribute this world to just circumstance and science. And so the Torah says, "V'im b'zos lo tishmu li." You still won't listen to all my messages and all the suffering in the beginning of the Tochacha. "V'alachemi mi b'keri," and you'll treat me keri. Keri comes from the same root, kuf reish, karcha, keri, ki kare. You'll treat me with inconsistency rather than seeing providence and rather than seeing hashkacha. So what's my punishment to you? I'll reciprocate. Instead of punishing you, because even when a person's punished, he still feels the presence of Hashem. We used to ask Rav Amital, someone once asked a famous question of Rav Amital in a Holocaust discussion, where was God during the Holocaust? And Rav Amital gave a simple and direct answer, he was with us in Auschwitz. Sometimes we expect Hashem to be there at certain parts of our life, but not at other parts of our life. There's a famous story about Rav Lichtenstein. One of his daughters had a medical complication, and the entire family was gathered in the hospital waiting room, saying Tehillim, shaking and trembling, praying fervently to say Tehillim. I think Rabbi Schreiber quoted this story a couple of weeks ago. And then at a certain point, the doctors came out and informed the family that the medical crisis had passed. Everyone in the family was relieved, and they started hugging and kissing and relaxing, and someone was missing. Rav Aaron was missing. So they're looking for him. He was still in the corner saying Tehillim. So someone went over and kindly told him, "Abba, she's healthy. The doctors came out and gave a positive report." So Rav Aaron said, "What, I should only say Tehillim to HaKadosh Baruch Hu when I need him? Now that he has assisted and helped, I shouldn't say thank you through my Tehillim? You only say Tehillim when you need HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Think of your relationship with your parents. Sometimes parents get upset. You only call me when you need me. Or sometimes I can hear my children's voice. Uh-oh, here it comes. Haven't spoken to me in 3 days. What do you need?" Some of them are a little more diplomatic. They'll ask me a few nice questions. All right, what do you need? Some kids, I just hear from all the time. So we only want to celebrate HaKadosh Baruch Hu when you understand him, not when you don't understand him. Sometimes you don't understand Hashem. He's still there. He's still with us in Auschwitz. We can't make sense of it. You can always make sense of life. Life's about mystery and clarity wrapped up in some strange format. So of course you need a plan in life. You can't just run by the seat of your pants. You need a plan in life. You need a plan in your career. You need a plan as an adult. You need a plan. What are your plans for religion? You need to plan. What do you hope to grow and what mean? If I asked you an alarming question, 3 significant religious changes you're expecting to happen this year. Don't say improve your skills in Gemara, because it's a portal to religion, but it could be also an academic skill. I mean religious. You want to feel Hashem's presence more, daven with greater fervor, improve your midos, feel Eretz. Each one is different, I'm sure. Many of you have different plans. You need a plan. You need to have some sense of how we're going to get from point A to point B. But here's the hitch, and here's the rub. The message of Shiloh HaKen is that sometimes growth in life really is unplanned. And sometimes life surprises you. And sometimes a gust of wind comes that you don't anticipate. And sometimes a plan can be too imprisoning and can be too restraining and can provide the full sense of security and provide security, but at the cost of mediocrity or inertia. And that's the message of Kan Sipor, that some mitzvahs you can't prepare for. Some growth in life you just can't see coming. Every mitzvah you can prepare. When are you going to learn Torah? And when are you going to take a lulav? Everyone's going to buy a lulav this year, well before Sukkot. And everyone's going to bake their matzah well before Pesach. And everyone's going to buy their tefillin months before their... I mean, it has to be prepared in advance. Like, "Oh, I'm bar mitzvah today. Where's my tefillin? Oh, it's Pesach. I forgot to clean." Everything is planned. But then there's some times in life that you're exposed to new ideas and new people and new experiences. And then you face the following question. Do you run back to your past because it provides security and you refuse to change and you just clutch the altars of your youth because they provide identity, and then you cap off at mediocrity? What do you have that courage and honesty, and I'll talk about honesty and courage and confidence in yourself to say, "Oh, this is something new"? You should rethink. Rethink my identity. Rethink my plans. Rethink. This is really at the core of success this year. Don't think success is showing up this year. That's just the mechanism. That's just the medium. Don't think success is coming to this school. You come to this school and go to sleep. Going to sleep is also success. I like when kids sleep because you're exhausted. But success is stripping away to the bone and saying, what's new here in this yeshiva? Everyone came into this room with a plan for life, right? I imagine you're all well thought out. You're all successful more or less in high school. You had a plan, and hopefully at some point that plan included religion, and that plan included Torah, and that plan included Israel. But I can't imagine that anyone in this room hasn't been moved by what you've seen in the last 2 weeks. No way you could have imagined it unless you've been here before. Something very, very unique in this building. Smart people. People who could have cut their oats anywhere. I could have had a million different jobs. I promise you. I'm not gloating, because I did. I didn't become a Rebbe because I needed the money or I needed the thrill or because I like giving interviews for 20,000th time the same stupid question because I really cared about Torah. I didn't walk into this building with any of those plans. The last thing on my mind, I told you 2 weeks ago, the last thing, if you had asked me to script my future when I was your age, sitting really where Morty's sitting right now, that was my seat. Last thing I could imagine was living in Israel as a Rebbe in a lunch for that. Like, what are you crazy? I remember sitting down day one at lunch, turning to a boy, he's now a friend of mine, he's in Chinuch also, and I was still struggling to make sense of yeshiva. If you're struggling, it's totally natural because it takes a while for some people. And I turned to him and said, hi, my name is Moshe, I just started. Who are you? And he turned to me and said, hi, my name is Hillel, I'm Shana Gimel. And I looked at that guy as if he's a Martian. Why in your right mind would anyone want to stay in this building more than the 9 months of his prison sentence? Like, are you crazy? Shana Gimel, which planet did you land on? Do you have some communicable disease and you're quarantined to this building? Like, what are you, crazy? So here I am working on my Shana Lamed, who knows what, Lamed Vav, Lamed Zion, Lamed Vavdek, now Lamed Vavdek, Mashir Lamed Vav, Lamed Vav, 36 year. I guess at some point I was just an open person. I was not afraid to be open. At some point I just said, I can't just hold on to my past. It didn't happen overnight, didn't happen in Elden, even at my first year, but at some point I said, I'm now going to reassess who I am. I'm not going to rethink some of the equations. I rethought Israel. I rethought my major. You know what? That's probably the best decision of my life. Even if I never ended up in Israel, I never ended up a Rebbe, because the profession I chose when I was young was just simply a default, and my father was a dentist. I was going to be, it wasn't thought out. I know, I've always thought so. You know, why not? It's easy. Even if I hadn't made any other changes in my life, because when I thought about Israel, I said, I can't be a dentist because I need time to learn. I have to be something to back up. So I decided to be a computer scientist. Whatever, it was just my decision. That decision changed my life, even without Israel and Torah, because I was afraid of math, and now I try to confront math, and I learned about computers, and that was obviously something that was important for my future, and I changed my mind not to be penciled into certain profiles of how it operates. Oh, I'm a scientist. It was just liberating, just to rethink who I was, and to plan based on my 18, 19-year-old self, not based on my 15-year-old self, my 14-year-old self, or the accumulation of 17 years of tremendous experience being 12 years old or 15 years old. I can't tell you where to draw that line, because life is about planning, and life is about remaining, sticking to your guns and your principles and conviction. But and don't be afraid of that word change. These are the words that I think we won't act upon. We won't brainwash you. We won't indoctrinate you. We won't manipulate your vulnerability. We won't be simplistic about, I'm not going to herd you into a room and bang on the table until everyone submits. Not that it would work. And even in private conversations, we're going to respect whom you are and try to help you create long-lasting endurance. But if you don't think you're here in yeshiva for change, I'll say it bluntly, you may as well leave now. Because the rest is just going through the motions. You just go through the motions, really. You get refunds. You get your lawyers to write this year for a refund. You're paying for food, you're paying for lodging, but what you're really paying for is people who care, people of passion, and people who will try to display some of that passion and in a personal manner, not just stand on stage and display their passion, but try to get to the core of whom you are and say, define yourself and pivot religion at the center point and then take it from there. You know, for you, a religious pivoted lifestyle is one thing, and for you, a religious pivotal, obviously there are common denominators, halacha, and Eretz Yisrael, and Talmud Torah, and Tefillah, and the Chazal, and everyone will express it differently. My first job in Israel was teaching in the former Yeshiva HaKotel, now Nativ Aryeh, the Reb Bina. I don't know if any of you know Reb Bina, but he's a very blunt person. Anyone meet Reb Bina? Very, very blunt. We're very, very close to this day, extremely close, and I'm a real admirer of him. So he would begin every year to the then Yeshiva Dakota voice by saying in his style, I'm not going to imitate his voice, although it's a very imitatable voice. He says, you know when your year ends, you can hear his voice, I'm not going to do it. You know when your year ends? When you get off the plane. He would say, when you land in Ben-Gurion. Why? Because then the classes start, and the schedule starts, and the response. And then you go through the motions. You're back in high school. High school, you're not looking to change. You're looking just to fulfill your requirements. Because you're not defining yourself. You're being defined by your container. Now, for the first time, you're getting up and defining yourself. And for the first time, you're seeing things that hopefully challenge. Not to challenge your past in a condescending way, that everything about your past was flawed, everything about your past was impure. But I think it's more about the application. Think about all the communities you come from, and you just pick an average member from the community, and you sit down for an interview and say, do you believe in Talmud Torah? Yes! Now, how much Torah do you learn? Well, this and that, and a little bit lit. Do you believe in fervent tefillah? Yes! But so why do you talk during davening, a fifth person? Do you believe in Israel? Yeah! I don't think we're going to introduce new values here. We're not questioning your past. I think if you just line up all the values you were educated upon, I think it'd stack up pretty straightforward. It would be deep correlation. But now the question is execution. Learning to execute your values, learning to be disciplined, learning to be idealistic, learning to put conviction above convenience and principles above indulgence, and learning not to be lazy about it, learning not to be afraid. It's just... We're giving you, it's more like weightlifting. It's not, we're not changing the process. We're just giving you the muscles to execute that process. And really, these are the two ingredients. The two ingredients to change. And I know this like the back of my hand because I watch boys every year. The first ingredient you need to change is you need to be honest. And that's a real, real threshold to pass. To really be honest with yourself, to look inside yourself, to admit that you're not everything you thought you were, towering in the confidence of being the valedictorian, because it's easy to be the valedictorian in your high school. Come on, now you see this is the major leagues. If you find a high school, be valedictorian, that's not hard. Find a high school, be a good kid, that's not hard. In fact, the valedictorian is probably the biggest victim because he spends 4 years hearing how great he is, rather than people really actually looking into his heart and saying, well, who are you as a person? Right? If you're a valedictorian, my heart goes out to you because you're the biggest victim. If I were victims, raise your hand. I told you guys many times, if I were a principal in America and I had one executive prerogative before I retired, my one-day principalship of all the schools in North America, would be to abolish valedictorians. Who in his right mind would dream up a world in which we reward people for having more brain cells? Like, why does that matter? Why is that even important? Why don't we change the tallest person gets the award. Person with the nicest hair. Why would we award people for brain cells? And the more you grow in life, the more you realize that brain cells are really overrated. They get you extra zeros on your salary, but they don't help with the things that matter, like relationships and experience and honesty. And those things, in fact, sometimes they're inhibitors. Sometimes the smarter you are, the harder it is for you. So we spend 4 years celebrating some random God-given, I don't call it a gift, because brain cells, like everything else, it's a gift and it's a curse. Let me give you a list of the curses of being too smart. Maybe you know, maybe you don't. You rattle off like the back of my hand. One of the greatest pleasures in my life is I'm not a scintillatingly smart person. If I had IQ's tests, I wouldn't score high. I don't have that curse. Or else I'm too smart for my own good. I can't see things straight because I'm blinded by intellectual paralysis. I see things pretty clearly because I'm not that smart. If I had to offer an award, by the way, in Israel we don't give awards. In Israel people just graduate together. Everyone's really happy for each other. No one's going home crying. Why did I not get the award? He got the award. Everyone just graduates. If I had to give an award, it would be the best person. Who gets the best person award? And I sit down with the other staff members and we create a list of metrics, kindness, devotion, humility, sincerity, honesty, whatever they'd be. And we'd rank the boys based on those 10 metrics and we'd find the best person. That's really what we're here. You're here to become a smart person? Like, who cares? Why would you even care about that? You care about being a good person. That's far more important than how smart you are. I'm sure you realize that by now. And you realize that we could care less. And quite frankly, we care less. I think we're pretty smart. I mean, we're not saying, intelligence is not important because we're dumb. We don't have it. I think we're pretty smart in this issue. I think we're pretty intelligent. And so if we say it's because we really believe it, It's because we're not jealous of the smart people. I'm really not. I'm sad for them sometimes because I see how much challenges they have in life. So what you really need is honesty. Look at yourself. Look into your own heart and try to find... I mean, we're going to start the real Elul in a few days. The first 2-3 weeks are just easing you into yeshiva. The real Elul is, it's rigorous, it's hard, it's stripping away all these layers of deceit and layers of ego and self-scripted narratives that we have to spin our whole lives just to defend ourselves against ourselves and to hide from it. But that's real change is honesty. And then we'll talk about this a lot this year. The next stage, some boys reach the threshold of honesty. Some boys, I mean, I've seen extreme cases, just to show you how extreme it can get. Extreme cases of dishonesty. Well, literally, boy just is a no-show in the base medrash and in Firminyan, and we try our hardest to find out at some point. It's like, where are you? I'm in the base medrash. It could be so self-deceiving. Because in some cases, kids just need that to cope because they're creating alternate realities. Literally, guy doesn't show a minute in the base medrash, he thinks he's in the base medrash. That's obviously extreme. But this, I'm showing you an exaggerated case just to demonstrate how low you can sing, how far you can go if you're dishonest with yourself. Obviously, it's much more subtle. Most people don't have those levels of self-deceit, but there's a lot, and that's why it's important not to lie. It's important to be an honest person in life, because if you start lying, you can become a chronic liar, and then it's contagious, and then you lose the ability to tell the truth about yourself. The boundaries become between truth and falsehood become very, very blurred, and you tell yourself certain things, and they're not true, and you have to tell yourself certain things. Deep down in my heart, I think I'm learning 14 hours a day. I'm lucky if I learn 14 minutes a day, because that's what I did when I was in yeshiva, and that's my dream for life, and at some point, it's what I'd like to do, and I'm happy that every day I imagine I am. But then there's a danger. I'm actually sitting and learning and getting close to that. How can I close the gap between that image and that dream that I have and my actual performance? So a lot of kids never reach that threshold. It's hard sometimes. It's really hard work. It's hard. It's harder than a Seder. It's harder than a math equation. Math equation is extrinsic. The you, is facing something extrinsic, the equation. It's honesty about yourself, it's about you. You need a lot of tenacity. Generally, secure people with a high degree of self-esteem can do it because their identity isn't pitched upon being perfect. So that's why it's important to have good self-esteem, to feel good about yourself. So I feel good about myself. Not because of my performance, and not because I just feel good about myself, because people love me, and I have people that I care about, people care about me, and I can make mistakes, I can make errors. It's not going to make me less of a person. It's not going to make me inferior as a person. A lot of people get stuck at the next stage. I think a lot of boys in this yeshiva get to the honesty where they realize, oh, I realize who I am and what my life is, and the next step is courage. Well, can you really pull the trigger? Can you make a change? And a lot of people balk at that second stage. I know what, and I'd like to, and I realize that, and it would be superior if, but it's hard because I know what I had in the past, and it was successful, and I just don't want to give it up. This week's parsha. Uvachsa saviya vasima yarech yamim. This Yafas Tohar spends 30 days crying, and part of it is, I mean, we're giving her a better life. We're taking her away from savagery and paganism and cannibalism and blood drain. We're taking her to a life of monotheism and ration and science and progress. And just take the leap. Just come. Just go. Just, right? I don't know. So some of you think about, was this a courageous decision for you to come to yeshiva? Were some of you afraid that it's too hard? Some of you afraid you didn't have friends? Some of you, whatever. And look how redeeming it is when you take an act of courage, when you just say, I'm going to do it because I know that I can, and I have the confidence, and I'm going to leave my comfort zone and go somewhere else. So it's a good parsha in the beginning of the year. Hashem planned the parshios. Good. It's a good parsha to think about change. Think about, on the one hand, plans. On the other hand, being nimble, being able to pivot in life. Life will never, I can promise you one thing. I hope every one of you has a blessed life and a successful life and doesn't face adversity or tragedy. But life's going to turn on you pretty quick. And whatever you anticipate, life's going to have a very different trajectory. And some people are just very, very wooden-headed. They can't shift in life. They just know who they are, and they're old dogs, and I don't want to learn any new tricks. And this is good not just for religion, it's good for life. You want to beat Alzheimer's? Get a new hobby every year. Remap your mind. Remap your emotions. Learn something new. Find some new gusts, some new experience. that will prevent you from getting old and from letting your mind atrophy and letting your... A couple of years ago, I did laser surgeries. I had two choices. Since I was an advanced age, they could either correct my eyes 20/20, in which case I wouldn't wear glasses. I would wear reading glasses, glasses. So I would have perfect vision for a 50-year-old or for a 47-year-old. 47-year-old people need reading glasses because even if they have perfect vision, their muscles are weak. It's not a question of the way it hits the retina. Your muscles just get weaker. So to read, you need... So I would have exchanged my glasses for reading glasses. I'm not looking for reading glasses. I want a free ticket out of glasses. So they said, well, we have this option. Not a lot of people choose it. It's a little bit crazy. It's a little bit courageous, like bungee jumping, but see if you want it, where they make one eye long and one eye short. Like one eye sees for long and one eye sees for short, and then your mind trains itself over the course of a year. You're seeing double pretty much for a year, and then your mind trains yourself which eye to use for reading and which eye for long distance. I said, oh man, bring it on. Turn up the dial. Give me x-ray vision. I want to see through like Superman. Turn it up to the max. I'm in. And for a while, it was tough. Like, which eye? All of a sudden, you're used to seeing the world one way. Literally. I don't mean figuratively. Seeing the world. You're used to seeing the world one way. It was great. Great experience. I felt refreshed by it. All of a sudden, my mind had to create new mappings. Okay, I'm not recommending anyone go for the surgery. Optionally. I thought you said get for surgery. Turn the dial up. Give me the max. No, obviously. But in life, it's good to have this balance. It's everything in this room, it's a balance. You'll soon see nothing, almost nothing in life is perfect in excess. Everything is dangerous in excess, and it's about balancing. So you need to have plans. You need to be planned out. You need to be thorough. Remember once interviewing a boy, not going to say which high school, but his high school is well represented in this room. Let's just put it that way. Well represented in this room. So many of them go to high school and say, what are your plans? I meant like, for Israel, for college, he says, well, I plan to go to yeshiva, then to go to college, graduate with a degree, get married in 1997 it was, have children, live here, have three children, have a car, have this, and retire at the age of 60. So, whoa, just want to know what you're doing next year, that's all. Just TMI, you know, this is before TMI even was a phrase. Like, all I want to know what your college plans are. Not even that, just like what your professional interests are. Okay, so I accepted the kid out of Rahman. I accepted the kid. He's actually pretty successful. He's a Ben Torah today. He's an Opin Baruch Hashem, a nice Opin Hashem. Okay, so, but sometimes you really are trapped. Anyone ever read Henry James? Henry James was a very part of a very famous, unfunny Reb Lichtenstein joke, which is not saying much because Reb Lichtenstein at one Hanukkah Mesiva wanted to have a riddle for the boys, like a funny riddle to get the boys. So he asked the boys, which set of late 19th century English brothers, one of whom was a philosopher who really wrote essays, and the other of whom was an essayist who really wrote philosophy. I expected the Israelis to get that one. So of course, Rav Aaron, of course, everyone failed. It was William and Henry James. William James was an essayist who wrote a book of philosophy called The Varieties of Religious Experience. It's a beautiful book that Rav Lichtenstein is a big fan of. And his brother Henry James was a philosopher who wrote novels. So one of Henry James' novels, really interesting novel, short little novel, is called Beast in the Jungle. It's about a young man who has a premonition that he'll accomplish something great in life. And that premonition of grandeur freezes him and paralyzes him because every decision he takes, well, how will this contribute to my future premonition? How will this contribute to the glory that I dreamed of? So he can't get married. He can't take a job. He can't sit because everything is overcalculated. And that premonition becomes the beast in the jungle that frightens him into paralysis. It's a metaphor. It's as if you're somewhere, there's a beast behind every hedge and you can't move. It's a really beautiful essay. A really beautiful novel. So how do you find that sweet spot? Well, I can tell you in life it's a sweet spot and it's a balance. But one thing I can tell you, there are different parts of your life. There are times for stability and planning, and there are times for fresh exposure to new ideas. It's clear to both of us, you and I would both agree, that this is the year of exposure to new ideas. And I can only plead with you to open your heart. I can only plead with you not to clutch too tightly to your past, because that's the secure known rather than the insecure unknown. Because that's where real growth lies. And have that trust and that confidence that nothing here is irresponsible or disproportionate or doctrinaire. No one's pushing you into a place that's demonizing your past or dismissing your past or disrespectful to your... It's just, how can I take the you that's here in front of me and all the values that have been infused into you, now can I take those Torah values and magnify them and amplify them so that they preoccupy you emotionally, so that you express them deeply, so that you commit resources to them rather than in the background. When there's no new idea, I don't think anyone will tell you an idea this year that you didn't hear in your upbringing. You didn't hear about Talmud Torah, you didn't hear about Tefillah, you didn't hear about Zion, of course you did. But somehow they're on the back burners, and the real passion, the real time investment are other things, scholastics and academics and profession and sports. And now all of a sudden, let's take all those values and enunciate them and pivot them to your heart, rivet them to your heart. So think about that when you read Ki Yikare. Some things you can't prepare. Some things have to be impromptu, have to be ad hoc, have to be spontaneous. And you can't always anticipate what's happening. And sometimes the greatest leaps in life are those you didn't plan. For sure. If I'm looking back at some of my great leaps forward in life, a lot of them were things I couldn't see coming, and a lot of them, interestingly enough, are situations that initially frustrated me, but didn't just have a silver lining, but catapulted me in ways I couldn't. There was one event that happened to me in college that I thought was the worst thing that would ever happen to me, and it ended up allowing me to meet my wife and getting a job. It was just a complete inverse. So you can't be that, it's not just planned and meditated, but that controlling. Life has a rhythm of its own. And a lot of life isn't proactive, it's responsive. And some people don't have the ability to be responsive and reactionary. It's not just planning and sticking to your plans, because you see a lot of people who are holding on to plans that just have become obsolete and antiquated. Some people are reactionary. Oh, now that this has changed, how am I going to react to it? Okay, I want to stop here because I can talk a lot about this, and I'd like to talk a lot about it, but I want to make sure talk a little bit about September 11th. And I want to speak about it with you on three levels, and three levels in order. And you'll see what I mean in a moment. That's why I'm outlining what I'm speaking about. Normally I don't outline, it's just stream of consciousness, whatever hits me. But I want to make sure that I outline it for you. I want to speak about September 11th at a human level. And then I want to speak about it at a religious level. And then I want to speak about it at an existential level, in terms of how you view your existence, your identity, even independent of religion, because religion and identity are wedded. But I want to speak about the personal level first. And I want to preface the conversation with a story that was told in this building a few months ago that I think is reflective of the balance I'm trying to strike. On Yom HaZikaron, which as you'll see, in many, 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 many months, is a very, very holy day in this country. It's a very soulful day. It's a very deep day. And forget, just store it away. You'll get to it. The yeshiva invited Ophir Shire, who is the father of Gilad Shire, one of the three boys who were kidnapped, and you were just at the monument the other day. Ophir Shire is an alumnus of the yeshiva. Ophir Shire comes to Daven Yom Kippur in yeshiva every year, and I'll point him out to you on Yom Kippur if you're around. And Ophir Shire came to speak at the yeshiva on Yom HaZikaron about his son. And he told the following story. He said that during the Shiva, he, of course, welcomed an endless parade of great Rabbanim who came to visit him. And each rabbi offered something more inspiring than the next, or than the last. Oh, your son, he's in Shemayim with Rabbi Akiva, and your son died al Kiddush Hashem, and your son was a Karban, and your son was Haruge Malchus, and your son. And he said that when Rav Lichtenstein came into the room, he just felt as if someone just understood, a rabbi understood, that he was just crying for his son. Not for a martyr, and not for Rabbi Akiva Jr., and not for great Kedosha, just a father missed his son and was suffering the trauma of losing a son. Nothing more, nothing less. Yes, not sure. Okay, I remember I said it before. Nothing more, nothing less. A lot of times when events happen that are tragic and traumatic, we ask ourselves why. And we try to interpret them. And as religious-minded people and ideologically-minded people, we offer interpretations. And I will offer interpretations for your time allowing. But when tragedies strike, your first response has to be at a human level. People are suffering. And sometimes ideology accelerates the process and you forget the human element. It just becomes an event of ideas rather than an event of people. I remember September 11th, a friend of mine whose son was in another yeshiva, a very different yeshiva. I don't mean Shalavan, I mean a different yeshiva. And he called me up and he said that in the hours after September 11th, the Rebbe of that yeshiva gathered the boys together, hours later, and issued a ringing condemnation of American capitalism and Western opulence. Now, these towers were failed because they were a symbol of decadence. And I told my friend, in my opinion, you should call your son and pull him out of that yeshiva as quickly as possible, because whichever Rebbe said that isn't a role model, he's a monster. People are dying. People are trapped under tons of concrete, whispering their last goodbyes to their loved ones on dying cell phones. People are incinerated in this infernal heat. People are flying out of windows. People are, it's ghastly. It's grotesque. And when people are suffering, you're pointing fingers and you're, that's repulsive. It's horrific. Torah can't be built on horrific moral rot. It's disgusting. To be careful in life, not to just jump on the ideology train and forget the fact that human beings just turn into one large ideological Shakespearean drama. What are the messages? The messages? People are being buried alive. A couple years ago, I was interviewed by a Japanese radio station after the tsunami. How they got to me. They wanted a rabbinic voice in the tsunami. And I just said, I'm happy to speak as a rabbi, but first I'm speaking as a person. People are dying. People are losing everything. People are losing loved ones. You don't all of a sudden hide an ideology and immunize yourself to human suffering. People suffered on this day. Most of you obviously were too young to remember. People suffered, first responders suffered, great chesed. Again, I'm speaking about the United States of America, but the same would have happened, no doubt, in England, in South Africa, Australia. We built a world of care. We built a world of trying to protect life and preserve life, and people are willing to sacrifice their lives under great, great threat and great peril to try to save other people's lives. And not to feel that, not to respond to that, not to sense that. And there are people today. Well, let me make it personal for you, okay? When I leave at 7:15, you know my first call is going to be? It's not going to be to a Rebbe friend. I have many Rebbe friends waiting to speak to me. It's like every year, September 11th, I call a woman I've never met. A woman I've never met. A Catholic woman I've never met. I've never seen her. She's my banker for the last 27 years or so since I made Aliyah. Never met her. We just exchanged emails. And her company, Morgan Stanley, was positioned in the World Trade Center. And she didn't lose any family members. But I just know that inevitably she and her coworkers lost a bunch of people. And I'm sure that today they're thinking about their friends and coworkers. And I just wanted to know that all the services she provides for me, I'm thinking of her today. I'm an Israeli guy. She won't pick me out of a lineup. It's a two-minute call. It's a symbolic call. It's like a ritual. I just say, Lisa, I just want you to know we're thinking about you here. Because I know she and her coworkers were at some level suffering. I don't really know, obviously, if I knew survivors and victims, and so I would call them. I don't know anyone. There's still, Jews that I know who are caught in that, and I'm sure there were, obviously, were Jews. But, so this is the close I have, and I wanted to know them feeling whatever they're going through. So be careful when the tragedy strikes, not to get lost in some ideological spin. And certainly be careful, which is the second part of this disgusting story, not to play God. You really know why the World Trade Centers were failed, because it's a symbol that really, that's such smug arrogance to play the role of God. Thousands of people die. You can just neatly package it into some divine message. Remember with Hurricane Katrina, people knew why it happened because George Bush had policies that were offensive to Israel. It's not just morally repugnant, it's theologically bankrupt. Playing the role of God? If there's one thing you guys know after 2 weeks, is that the attempt to try to circumscribe Hashem is futile. Does anyone now, having been here for 2 weeks, ever imagine that they'll finish Torah? It's laughable. And not because of your level, my level, anyone's level. My kids come in to me and I say, I'll be going to finish. Well, never, never, never. I'm chasing the elusive infinites. It's so exciting about Torah. I'll never finish it. It's the only field I ever encountered that had that feeling. When I studied math, I got the sense that if I really invested in it, I could become really great at math and cover it. When I studied literature, when I studied everything I studied, I felt like I can see it's far from me, but I could see there's a boundary to it. I can imagine a boundary to this. Maybe I'll never reach the boundary. Torah, by definition, doesn't have a boundary because it's a Kodesh Baruch Hu. By definition, it's infinite. And that's what makes it so exciting. I'm chasing something beyond mortal reach. And if it crushes you, well, that's the price of admission into the ring of eternity. You want to study something mortal that you can conquer? It'll be easy. You want to study HaKadosh Baruch Hu? It's going to crush you. Do you have the chops to be crushed? You have the chops to face off with this 300-pound gorilla. You always lose to the 300-pound gorilla, but it's better than wrestling some pipsqueak, than wrestling some squirrel. You want to wrestle a squirrel or wrestle a 300-pound gorilla? Wrestle a 300-pound gorilla. It's going to crush you. Kurdish Barak was a 300-pound, 3,000-ton gorilla. His will crush you, but that's the joy of being in the ring with a Kurdish Barak. So be careful about not skipping steps, and be careful about not playing God. The second issue is, but it's clear this wasn't just an attack on some random building. This was an attack in the name of God and in the name of religion. And we're people who care deeply about the face of God in our world. And September 11th, they attacked a building, but they also hijacked Hashem on those planes. Because Islamic fundamentalism is trying to convince the world that God is angry, and God is hateful, and God has a bloodlust, and when people die, God is happy, and God is cruel, and God is haphazard, and God is militant and vengeful. And listen carefully to my next sentence. Because they speak in the name of God, and they speak in the name of monotheism, because Islam is Muslims are monotheists. And I'm not talking about Islam per se, I'm talking about Islamic fundamentalism. They're very different. But denying the ways of God is tantamount to denying God. These people are heretics, even though they speak of a God, because they speak of a God who doesn't exist. God isn't angry. God doesn't hate. Mechalek el chayim b'chesed. We encounter the moments that people suffer, and we struggle with that suffering. What about the countless, innumerable moments that people don't suffer? Just think of your own life, okay? It's been 18 years since September 11th. Every minute Hashem is providing you with health, and every minute Hashem is providing you with chemical balance, and every minute, and in a couple weeks, the Darkeinu kids will march into this yeshiva and sit in the classroom, right near the classroom that Rabbi Schreiber Shear is in and my Shear is in. And it's a very, very potent and very poignant contrast, because the difference between your sitting in Rabbi Schreiber's class or my class or sitting in the Darkeinu class is about 3 minutes of oxygen when you were born. If you have 3 minutes less oxygen, you're CP and you're in the Darkeinu group. And if 3 minutes more oxygen, so no one knows why Hashem chose you and didn't choose them for the oxygen. But just know that oxygen is ongoing. 3 minutes of that oxygen for your whole life, you become a vegetable. And a little bit chemical, when we see people who are severely depressed and can't pull themselves out of the depression, it's a simple slight change in chemical balance or even temperature for hormones to act or fire or not fire. People that have neurologically degenerative diseases, it could just be hormonal because the neurons can't fire. And every minute, Erev Avoker, only Secha Shibuchayam Imanu V'al Niflo, Secha Shibuchayam Erev Avoker, if it's all right. You wake up tomorrow, feel pretty natural, but you know what? It's not. Because you die and you're reborn. And Hashem cares for people and cares for humanity and wants us to care for humanity and wants us to care for our world because we want to be like Hashem. We want to be kind and just and compassionate and merciful. And there was an interesting book published right after September 11th. It was actually written before, but it was good that it was published after because it fits post-September 11th conversation. It was written by a Mideastern historian called Bernard Lewis, actually British. And the name of the book was What Went Wrong? And the question of the book was, how did Islamic culture, which had enjoyed so many centuries of supremacy in every sector, science, technology, math, culture, industry, commerce, all of a sudden, 1500, 1600, 16th century, it abdicates that supremacy to Western civilization. And the question is, what went wrong? How did Islam lose its supremacy, which is really the reason of September 11th, Islamic rage, hatred of Western civilization, jealousy. How did Islam lose its supreme position? And I found the premise of that book really provocative, and I tried to answer it as a religious person. He answers it as a scientist, scientific developments, cultural. I answered it as a rabbi, as a religious person. If you see God as angry and haphazard and circumstantial and not caring about human experience, then when you see suffering in this world and you see a world that's backwards and futile, and then you have absolutely no religious impetus to change it, because God is pretty happy when human beings suffer. At least he's haphazard. There's no rhyme or reason. He's random. My God, our God, is a caring, compassionate, loving God who wants human beings to enjoy a world of welfare and advance and comfort. And when that world fails to live up to those expectations, I have a religious responsibility to change it and reformat it in the image of my God. Science for a Jew is driven by a religious impulse. I want to change my world. I want to improve my world because I believe Hashem wants me to. Hashem wants health, and Hashem wants change, and Hashem wants indoor plumbing, and Hashem wants the internet. Hashem wants the world to advance so that human beings have a higher quality of life because Hashem cares for His creatures. And if the world suffers, then it's Jonas Salk's responsibility to improve it. And if the world suffers, then it's an Israeli Nobel Prize winner's responsibility to improve it. And that's why Jews are always at the forefront of medicine, science, technology, the advance of the human condition, social reform. Because if our world is imperfect, then Hashem is not happy when our world is suffering. Hashem wants human beings to enjoy welfare and prosperity. And sadly, if you interview 10 random people in the street today and you say, what are the words that first you associate with religion? Most people will say death, fanaticism, hatred, anger, war. So that's part of our struggle, is to defend the face of Hashem in this world and to at least show people what Hashem is. In 3 weeks, we'll think about Hashem's malchus. Does it hurt you that Islamic fundamentalism is vandalizing the face of Hashem in this world? Does it bother you? Does it bother you, the state of Hashem in this world? Does it bother you that so many people confuse jihadism and chronic, abhorrent, despicable, homicidal murder with Jews who die al Kiddush Hashem? We have no death wish as a Jew. We don't look for death. But every single Jew lives with that sense and should live with that sense that you may be called upon to give your life for your God and your people. Because that's something a Jew lives with his whole life. We have no death wish. We don't seek death. We seek life. We seek to change the world. But if you're really serious about standing for Hashem in this world, then you have to be equally serious about standing for Hashem if it comes to that. Otherwise, you're not serious or you're not fully in. You're just serious on your terms. Well, I stand for Hashem if I can watch the game and eat my popcorn. That'll make a brachas a Muslim. What about to pay everything? What about to pay the entire price? Because your life is not for yourself. Your life is for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But there's a big difference between Kiddush Hashem and jihadism. There's a big difference between killing other people and using that as your ticket of entry into the next world. What does that say about the two worlds? It almost assumes the two worlds are different. You can commit a crime in this world and enter the next world. You know what Olam Haba is? Close your eyes and I'll tell you what Olam Haba is. You're in this room. Are you listening to Rabbi Tarragon speak? Or someone else speak? The only thing is you're not hungry, so you don't care about leaving. You're not weak, so you don't care about resisting. You're not confused, so you don't care about arguing. You have nowhere to go but to listen to Hashem's will. Obviously, it could be me, maybe anyone else. Olam Haba is exactly this world. It's exactly this world. Without the inhibitions and the limitations and the deficiencies of this world. You can't get to Olam Haba by committing a crime against humanity. That would suggest disconnectedness and disintegration between the two worlds. Oh, yeah, Islamic fundamentalist suicide bomber who kills himself and takes other people's lives in an act of homicide for his Olam Haba, for his 72 virgins. Whose name is he sanctifying? No one's name. He's just serving his own coarse, bestial pleasures. One thing I can promise you, I haven't been to Olam Haba, one thing I can promise you, you know, 72 virgins. That I can guarantee you. There are no virgins in the next world. And there's no food, and there's no buffet. And you're not winning every sports gamble you place. There's nothing physical about the next world. Look how many aspects of our religion are being distorted by September 11th. Olam Haba, Kiddush Hashem, the face of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our world. So you're not all of a sudden going to start a website and convince the world or get 10 million viewers on Instagram. Leave that to me. Seriously, at least in your own mind, establish clarity about what Olam Haba is, what Kiddush Hashem is, who HaKadosh Baruch Hu is. So September 11th is first and foremost a day to really feel people's pain, and second of all, to remember that this is a battlefield of ideas, not just a battlefield of terror and And then finally, of course, just kind of want to be as comprehensive as possible. It also reminds us that, you know, obviously, towers are iconic. And when human beings try to build towers, they fall. And we're never as secure as we think we are. See, you didn't live before September 11th. I did, obviously. America was caught in this spin of invulnerability. America, Western civilization. Because they've been so successful, and it was really a 50-year process. Because they'd been so successful in World War II, they defeated Nazism. Because communism fell. Because the economy was booming. Because we had improved our world so dramatically. Air conditioning, vacuum cleaners, equal rights. Big business, big government could save the world, could solve any issue. The prequel to September 11th was really AIDS in the 80s. Because part of this response to human fragility was, well, we can solve the microbial world, and we can solve polio, we can solve disease and smallpox and measles and mumps, and then all of a sudden this invisible world was a lot more powerful than we thought. And we didn't have a solution. We still don't have a foolproof solution. And thematically, September 11th provided that second dose. We try to build towers, and quite frankly, we should build towers because Hashem wants us to try. But not to presume that we're fortressed against failure simply because we're locked up in a tower, real or imagined. The first tower the humans tried to build was Migdal Bavla. It wasn't just a tower. It was combining human thought and human language and human faculty and trying to defend against the Mabul. It was a moment of iconography. It was a moment of narrative. Can we defend ourselves against the powers beyond us? We can. Let's build a tower and support the heavens so they won't explode on us again. And the tower fell. And the next tower was Nebuchadnezzar's tower. And Nebuchadnezzar was this indomitable force, the first multi-regional empire. He controlled the entire world. He was a prequel to Ahasuerus, Mehodu Ad Kush. Ahasuerus developed the idea through Nebuchadnezzar. And his tower fell. So we live in an age of towers and skyscrapers. And those are icons and metaphors for technology and science. But we're more dependent and more vulnerable than you think. And vulnerability is good. It's sobering. It's real. It puts you in touch with need. It puts you in touch with delicacy. It makes you feel other people's need more. It's honest. That's who we are as people. It helps our tefillah. One of the great bulwarks of the Haredi world, and you'll see this, the next time you visit your Haredi cousins, take a minute or two extra because I'll give it back to you. The next time you visit your Haredi cousins in Ramat Beit Shemesh or in Ramat Eshkol or in Bnei Brak, say, Rabbi Tarragon asked me, he gave me a project, this is a field project. He asked me to look at the Sefer Gemachim. Can you take out your Sefer Gemachim? You know what a Gemach is? If you want to borrow this and borrow that, they will take out something resembling a shas. Which letter do you want? Well, is it gemach for sunglasses, eyeglasses, 3D, not 3D, glasses, contact solution, nose plugs, ear plugs, eye plugs, hair plugs, foot plugs, teeth plugs? You can't imagine a gemach for computer time, a gemach for app development, a gemach for challen with beans, without beans, challen pots. Quite frankly, if I need something, I go to the store and buy it. If your parents need something, you go to the store and buy it. In that world, they don't have as much financial solubility. You can argue the point. I'm just assessing. Because they have more need, they share resources more freely than we share resources. They share everything. The less need you have, the less sensitive you are to need. And of course, the less generous and charitable you are because you lock yourself into prisons of self-sufficiency. I have what I need, so I don't give, I don't take. Law, follow the law. You don't deserve. So this isn't demonization, it's just a warning. We should progress, but don't let the progress create this false aura of invincibility. Nothing is. These tirades against progress, God, for tirades against towers, that's ridiculous. Of course, build towers, real and metaphoric. Of course, Hashem wants us to advance and develop, but don't let the towers become mirages for human invulnerability. And a lot of that fell on September 11th. Of course, it's terribly tragic that it fell. I'm just trying to assess what happened. Don't cast a stone that anyway, misinterpret. Thank God. Not thank God. It's just, it allowed certain people to recalibrate that balance between success and potency and vulnerability and fragility. Okay? Stop here.